Blog Talk Radio.
Live from the nation's capital, it's Quintessential Listening, Poetry, with host Dr. Michael Anthony Ingram.
Michael Anthony Ingram, and welcome to the program. My special guest tonight is the esteemed poet and author, Carla Lynn Merrifield. Carla, are you with me?
I am.
Hello.
With you. Hi. Good evening, Michael.
Hello. We made it happen.
Yes. You know, this technology thing, you know?
Yeah. Where are you calling in from?
I am calling in. I'm in North Fort Myers, Florida. So
okay.
I can send you some warmth.
Okay, thank you. We need it in Washington, D.C. I am so glad that you're here. You just don't know. Mm-hmm. You just don't know. You've made my month already.
Oh, thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Let me ask you a quick question. Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
To start this journey. All right. You've written hundreds of poems, extremely prolific. What is poetry?
Oh, I think it's poetry is primal. There is a group of paleoanthropologists who have come to more or less a consensus that when humans first started to try and create language and use their vocal cords, they were imitating birds. So that there's a belief that our first vocalizations were actually songs that imitated the birds, and they tried to adapt and adjust their songs to their world. And it sounds rather far-fetched, I think, but when you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. And I think that I really do think that those first songs were really the first poems. So we've been speaking and then later writing in poetry for a long, long time.
Yes.
So it's part of who we are as human beings.
Right. And you've already answered this question. You're already so eloquent in terms of what you just shared. Why is it important? Why is poetry important?
I think we need it more than ever now. Poetry, among many things, poetry heals. It takes us into another world in a way that prose doesn't, because of the musicality. And I think, you know, then there's the message that's in those beautiful sounds. Like, you know, right now there's just a lot of contentiousness going on in the world.
Yes.
And now we're facing, you know, this epidemic that's very scary. And I think poetry helps ground the human beings in their existence. I mean, little kids, what do we learn first? Nursery rhymes.
It's true.
So I do. I think, you know, there's that whole healing property of poetry. And I also think, you know, in those messages in the poems, it's a way to unify our human experience. And learn about the human condition. that, and it's just, you know, it's beautiful stuff.
Yes, it is. I agree. I am so glad you're here. What are some of the predominant themes of your work?
Oh, well, I've often talked about myself or presented myself as being a poet of place. I travel a lot. I bring back poems from around the world where I've been and observed. So there's a lot of that sense of nature and the environment is a very strong theme. And then I do quite a bit of ekphrastic poetry. So I look and interpret art and then write poems about it. And now I'm on a venture where I'm writing about music, particularly guitar music. So and then there's, of course, just the human things, my existence as a woman in contemporary society. I lost my husband 2.5 years ago, so I wrote poems about the process of his dying and the aftermath. So there's a lot. There's also, you know, the human element is very strong, and that's actually become stronger. I still do the travel and nature poetry, but it seems much more important right now to be writing about what's happening in our world and how we relate to each other. What makes us human? Relationships.
Yes.
Love.
Very much
so.
Love
poems.
Yes, I agree. Well, please share a piece of your work.
Okay. The one I'd like to start with, a number of years ago, I had the good fortune to be poet in residence at Everglades National Park. And rather than take a nature approach to the book, although there's certainly a lot of Everglades ecology in it, I also looked at the human history in the Everglades. And here's one that focuses on a particular moment in time in the Everglades early on. It's titled 1842. U.S. Army Expedition, 58 days, 85 soldiers, one native guide, one woman. My Seminole husband, your guide, earned a pittance, and I earned no thanks for my crane liver stew, no thanks for mending mosquito netting, no thanks for salves to soothe sunburn, sawgrass gashes, and poisonwood rashes. No thanks for sucking cottonmouth venom from puncture wounds. No thanks when you took my brown womanhood by force. I, Awanahohti, willow tree woman, who once bent to white men, I say, no, thank you.
Wow. That was beautiful.
Thank you.
And very telling in terms of just the strength of the poem itself. Such powerful imagery. You know, this is Women's History Month, and you're the first guest in our series of programs to celebrate Women's History Month. What does it mean to be a woman in the field of poetry?
Oh, I don't know. I don't think of myself as a woman in poetry. I often adapt personas, and sometimes they're male personas. But I do, I certainly have done quite a bit of protest poetry, speaking up for women, and as that poem just illustrated.
Yes.
And I did do my book Psyche Scroll, which came out in 2018. It's a book length poem, so it's one poem that's 126 pages. Anyway, but it's
wow.
A story. And I wrote it. To me, I'm still astounded by this. I wrote it well before like a year, 2 years before the Me Too movement happened.
Yes.
And it I must have channeled the gestalt of the time or something, because it's one woman, and every woman, at her attempt to balance her life in a world of male patriarchy, and she succeeds at the end. So it's kind of a psychological journey of how she overcomes some of the awful things that have happened to her, and the subjugation, the controlling boss, the father who beat her. I mean, that whole shooting match, and it's her triumph. And it's, I think it's uplifting and a way of looking at, we can all do this and we're all in this together. In that respect, I could put my pink pussy hat on and write some poetry from time to time. And it does happen. And there are journals, of course, that are always looking for a feminine voice. And I'm what do we call ourselves now? I'm a golden oldie. So a woman who's, seen some life over the years. So I bring that, kind of wise woman point of view to some of those kinds of poems.
Yes. And the title of the book again?
It's called Psyche's Scroll.
Psyche,
like your brain, your mind. Yes.
And now, is it available on Amazon?
It sure is.
Okay, great. Yeah. So everyone, pick up a copy of Psyche Scroll.
Oh,
it's available
you.
On Amazon.com. All right. How does a poem begin for you? Is it with an idea, a form, or an image?
Oh, it's all of the above. Sometimes I'll wake up in the morning, for example, and have a line in my head that tell, like an opening line. Sometimes I'll see something. I do a lot of photography, and I use it as a tool to provoke a poem. I'll stare, I'll stare at an image for a long time, and then all of a sudden something starts happening. And I just had that not too long ago, maybe 2 weeks ago. I was staring at a photograph I took of Eric Clapton's guitar. Honest to God, it was at an exhibit at the Metropolitan Museum of Art with a whole bunch of other famous guitars. So, and I called that picture up on my cell phone and I stared at it. I had just finished reading a biography of Eric Clapton, and I looked at that picture, and all of a sudden the poem started. And so it is. Sometimes it is an image. Or I don't know about form. Sometimes, I write often. I do a lot of haiku and tanka, the old Japanese forms, primarily tanka, for some reason, speak to me in terms of being a form that I want to work with. So sometimes I'll hear someone say something. I pick up a lot of opening lines by things people say in conversation. I'll make a little note and then I'll start the poem from that little phrase that just struck me a certain way. And sometimes I fall into these old forms like the tanka and the haiku. And not a year ago, I woke up one morning and I was scribbling in my journal, and this about what I was going to write, because I write just about every day, and this the word villanelle came up, and they're very difficult to do, and I haven't done them very many. But this poem I was just starting to noodle a little bit said, I want to be a villanelle. And I said, no, I'm not going to do a villanelle. And then the next day I sat down to write my journal, you're going to write. And the poem was like pounded at my head saying, it's time to write a villanelle. Now sit down and do it. And I mean, it's the oddest thing. So I did.
Well, will you share it with us?
Yeah, I will. I'd love to share it with you. It's called Villanelle of the Queen Mary II. Oh, to sail like an ocean liner plying the sea, every nautical mile to accept Poseidon's moist kiss, steady, steady on toward near infinity. Oh, to set a soul-changing course by stars' mythologies, wave-chasing Orion's constellated bliss. Oh, to sail like an ocean liner plying the sea. Oh, to navigate in moon's tidal grip of ebb and neap, to consort with Hecate in a benthic tryst. Steady, steady on toward near infinity. Oh, to cavort and gyre within the watery realms of behemoths and hear their spoutings hiss. Oh, to sail like an ocean liner plying the sea. Oh, to be foam, spindrift, the wind itself free, aloft in an aeolian embrace above the blue abyss. Steady, steady on toward near infinity. Oh, to be a woman on a storied ship voyaging nearly endlessly. Oh, then to come alongside, make fast, reminisce. Oh, to sail like an ocean liner plying the sea. Steady, steady on toward near infinity.
Another incredible piece.
Thank you. Thank you. It surprised me. It was a wonderful surprise.
You know, you write a lot. We know that. Where do you write?
Oh, everywhere. I mean, most often it's at home, sitting on the lanai here in Florida, or I'm a snowbird, so I'll go home and sit on my sun, you know, when the spring comes, I'll go home to Western New York and sit on my sun porch and write, or I'll take a folding canvas chair and go to a park. But I can sit, I mean, I wrote when I was on the voyage that's referenced in the Villanelle. I was on that ship for 108 days, and I wrote in the pub, in the disco, over the dinner table, in port, when we pulled into port sometimes, on a bus. So I can write anywhere, and I have I'm very blessed to have a gift of being able to block out my surroundings and focus on the words and hear the words as I'm writing them. So I'm very lucky. You know, put me anywhere. I'll start writing.
Wow. 108-day voyage?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. 22 countries. Yes. It was once in a lifetime thing.
It sounds like it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, let's take a brief break and we'll be right back.
Yes. Okay.
Thank you.
Again, my name is Michael Anthony Ingram. I'm here with caller Lynn Merrifield. The call-in number is 646-787-1631 if there are questions for caller Lynn. Caller Lynn,
okay.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
All great writers have great writing influences. Who are some of yours, and what makes them great in your eyes?
I started out as a young teenager. I've been writing since I was 11, and I was probably at that point most influenced by the Romantics, Wordsworth in particular, but also Byron and Keats, and certainly Shelley too. So they continue to have influence on me. That whole romantic impulse and their way of looking at nature, I think, is very much imbued in my writing. And you know, more contemporary, Mary Oliver, who was a great, I mean, I hate to label people, but a nature poet, you know. But it was just not just how she looked at nature, but you know, just the most exquisite lines, beautiful, beautiful lyric poetry. And then there's a great writer. He's done, he's got to be close to 40 books. His name is William Hahn. He's probably most known American contemporary poet, a friend of mine as well, and I studied under him. He's probably best known for several very powerful books about the Jewish Holocaust, and he's not Jewish. I mean, it's a remarkable story, but he was a great teacher, and now he's a great friend. 20 years later, from when I got my master's degree in creative writing, so he remains an incredible influence over me. I read everything he writes. I can sometimes try and imitate him, but I wouldn't dare. I mean, he's the master. I call him the great one.
Right.
So, and then other contemporary, another contemporary poet who I admire greatly, who influences me, is Jim Daniels. He's at Carnegie Mellon, and he's written a lot about, he grew up in Detroit, and he's written a lot of, you know, quote unquote, blue collar poems about life on the auto assembly line and when that fell apart. And so he, you know, he's one of my, you know, he keeps my conscience clean, reminding me about, you know, the others who are out there in the world. So those are, you know, Sharon Olds, who was, you know, great confessional poet. You know, she taught me how to, you know, write really good, you know, confessional works. And Elizabeth Bishop with her fabulous, fabulous, fabulous gift of image, I think. So there's, you know, I could probably rattle, you know, Whitman. I mean, you know, I call him, you know, St. Walt, who just, you know, took poetry in this country to such a new level that and changed us profoundly as poets. But,
well, let me ask this question. What made you want to be a poet? What made you feel the need to express yourself this way?
Believe it or not, it was not a poet. Anne Frank, The Diary of Anne Frank. My mom gave me that book when I was 11. And I just was swept away by, of course, the story and knowing, but that a brave young girl, you know, only a little older than I was when I read the diary, could write that way. It gave me such confidence. And I started keeping a journal or a diary, of course, I was 11 back then, and I still keep one. And I just, in writing in those, you know, dear diary, I started writing lines that I looked like a poem, and I did. I wrote my first poem when I was 11. It was dedicated to my brother, and I never stopped. It just, I found it. I found it, you know.
What is it that you found? What did you find?
Oh, just the magic of being able to put something on paper that communicated something powerful. I mean, the little poem about my brother is really quite sad because I loved him so much, and he kind of ignored me, and I was able to take that emotion and contain it in, I think it's two stanzas. It's like maybe, I don't know, 12 lines, you know, six and six or five and five, you know, stanzas. And have something that was moved and elevated me beyond the emotional distress of being ignored by my brother, which sounds so pedestrian. So it was an expression, being able to express myself. Wow. Oh, I just got to keep doing this. It feels so good. And it makes, you know, and it just, you know, it made me have a way of dealing with my emotions. I mean, you know, as a teenager, and then it just became a life habit. You know, how do I deal with myself as a young married woman in my 20s, or of course now as a widow?
Yes.
I found the magic. And have people,
you know,
read it and respond and get tears in their eyes or laugh or, you know.
Anyway. Well, a friend of mine was really looking forward to hearing you share your work because she's read you extensively, and she wanted to hear your voice, to put the voice with the words. So with that in mind, please share another piece of your work.
Okay. I'd love to share I referred earlier to discovering Eric Clapton's guitar, Blackie. So this is my Clapton poem. Clapton is God. Famed Blackie stared back at me through thick plexiglass at the Met's 2019 display. Play it loud, instruments of rock and roll. I saw him then from both sides, naked, front and back. Saw evidence of wear and tear he withstood, much like my own. And you see now, Eric Clapton, through the eyes of those dozens of 70s lay-down Sally Chippies you left by the side of so many backstage byways on your way to Stratocaster glories and creamy disaster. How I wanted to reach through the acrylic barrier to touch the simple yin and yang of your storied guitar. Glad you went straight. Glad you kicked all the nasty crap and survived a lasting grief. Glad you're still alive as of this lyric. I don't want to lose you. I don't want to lose you. I don't want to lose the blues you've given me. I'm like your Blackie on exhibit in a plastic case, as if built from three different 1950 Fender Strats. I am black and white, but a cobbled creature. I've been battered. Own up, atone before you die, fallen angel, almost risen. I don't want to lose you. I don't want to lose you. I don't want to lose the blacks and blues you've given me.
Why the poetry about the guitars?
Yes, I got a whole book about guitars that I'm working on and guitarists.
Why?
In fact,
why?
I learned
why?
To play
why
the guitar. They're sexy.
Okay.
That's it. That's the bottom line. They are. And they're just beautiful works of art. And then the people who play them and make them do what they do. I mean, I took piano lessons for 8 years. At the end of that, I could read music. I could play a few hymns, kind of. But it wasn't me. And I, you know, got on this kick about guitars and became fascinated by them. And I'm taking guitar lessons and I'm learning to play this instrument as part of this process of writing this book. And the guitar, you hold it up against your body and wrap your arms around it, and it sits down in your lap. It's just a totally different experience than playing a piano, which is out in front of you, you know, halfway arms distance. And they're just beautiful, beautiful creations, like gems. So, I know my brother was a guitarist, and I think that's part of it. You know, he's coming back from the dead to haunt me, you know, in writing this book. You know, he's with me, inspiring me to keep going and meet guitarists and talk with them and interview them and or read their biographies and get to know, you know, how they did what they did. And so it's a great, you know, magical mystery tour with the guitar. A romance.
Where do you a romance? I like that. Yes. Where do you hail from?
I'm originally from West Virginia. I was born and raised there. My family moved north to Rochester, New York, when I was 12, and I've kind of more or less been in Western New York the rest of my life. Except for 6 years in New York City, and of course now I'm retired, so I get to, you know, leave the cold behind and come to Florida. But yeah, just a little hick from West Virginia. I'm sitting here without my shoes on.
Many poets have different methods of writing. Some write on paper and then transfer to the computer. Others just type out their work again and transfer it. What's your preferred method of writing?
I prefer to write in my journal. The front part is I write from front to back, the daily entries in my journal, and then I write I scribble the poems in the back going towards the front, and then when they meet, it's time to start another journal. So I really like scribbling on a page, because I feel like if I'm writing an F or an S, somehow I feel the sound in my ear, so that I get a better sonics, better music when I write by hand. But you know, I just sit at my desk and there's the keyboard and it just starts spilling out. It just takes, I think, more revision that way to get the music up and the rhythms, that part of the poem, the sonics, to really sing. So by hand preferred, but you know, you could give me a grocery bag and I could write a poem on it.
And you could write a poem on it. Well, please share another piece of your work.
Okay. Here's one. There's a group of, they're gone now, a tribe of Indians going in the American West, in the American Southwest, called the Anasazi, the ancient Puebloans, they're now called, that predated the Hopi. So we're talking 400 to 1100 AD. Anyway, and they built these fabulous cities on their scale. And this is a story about their ending. The missing force at 36 degrees north latitude, 107 degrees, 57 minutes, 30 seconds longitude. That's the title. With the sun in its summer house, afternoon winds beat the sand's message of heat. Clouds assemble to drum thunderstorms, but no rains come. Where snake should swallow lizard, eagle swallows snake. Time swallowed whole the golden bird and its people, because no rains came. The magnitude of their loss is the magnitude of their epic ancient civilization, brought asunder by all the erosional forces you can name except one. When no rains came after solstice morning upon solstice morning, endlessly rainless, the wind worse than any desert wind I've imagined, a life-abrading wind, roared. Gravity toppled the Anasazi gods from atop their canyon temples. Great edifices of sandstone and great walls of rock and mortar baked and froze for silent ages and tumbled into ruins. Chaco without the force of water. Chaco becoming a message of the dust.
You know, they say that to see the world with complete honesty, one should look to comedians, artists, and poets. What do you think emerges naturally from your work?
What
emerges
what
naturally
emerges?
From you? Yes.
I think a sense of empathy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just read that the poem about the Anasazi disappearing, and earlier the Everglades poem about the poor woman with all those soldiers. And I think whether I'm writing about nature and the species that's going extinct, or I'm writing about someone's failed marriage or their stillborn baby, that I think, you know, that's seems to be where the generative emotion or point of view, in a way, even the guitars, you know, as silly as that sounds, I had a lot of feeling for Eric Clapton. He was a nasty son of a gun at times and really messed up and hurt a lot of people. But I could still, at the end, you know, love him and, you know, hope, you know, don't die on me, brother, you know.
Right.
Not yet.
Right.
So
right.
I think a lot of it is generated out of that. You know, I want to put something good in the world. I mean, not just the quality of the poem, you know, it's all the poetics of it, but something good and positive, even if they're sad. Or even if they're funny sometimes, you know, to make someone laugh and write, you know, bring them up out of their, you know, doldrums of, you know, February or March or whatever. So I think empathy has a lot to do with it.
You know, some years ago, I wrote an article for the Journal of Poetry Therapy.
Oh.
On the use of empathy in poetry. And one of the conclusions is that if you can't understand another person's story, attempt to resonate with the feelings that go along with that story, because it's a universal commonality in terms of our feelings.
Yeah.
So that was powerful for me to think about what you just shared, especially the poems about the group in Florida and the one that you just shared.
Yeah.
The title of the article was When I Dream of Paris.
Oh,
yes.
Oh, I'd love to read.
But enough
that.
About me. Enough about me.
Well, I want to know more.
No.
Okay. All right.
All poets, or maybe most poets, have several words that come up over and over again. Words or sentences that you just can't help but use in their work. What are three of your absolute favorite words to use?
Oh. Well, probably the very top word is kiss. I just think it's just one of the most wonderful words in the human language, I mean, the English language, kiss.
Okay.
It's just, I, you know, besides what it represents, I don't know. I when I was on that ship for all that time, I wrote something like 140 poems about kisses. And they did, and
that's
I,
a
and
lot
then
of kisses.
I, yeah, and different kinds and the different personalities of these kisses. I don't know. It's just such a sweet word. Maybe that's the that's my heritage from the Romantics. Blue comes up again and again and again. I've had people tell me, "Whoa, Carla, hey, you got your blue in there again." It just seems to be a color that it keeps popping up again and again and again, whether it's blue eyes or a bluebird or the sky or whatever. I guess it's my pet color in poetry. So that pops up a lot. So that's a favorite word. Bird.
Okay.
Birds figure really big in my book. And they pop up. And that's where we started this conversation. I was talking about how humans learn to, they believe that humans learn to articulate their first speeches as or their first efforts as songs imitating birds. So, and I'm fascinated by them, as well as I just that's another pretty word, bird.
Yes.
So
it is a beautiful
and
word.
Blue and bird.
Kind of, kiss the bluebird. Kiss the bluebird.
Kiss the bluebird. There you go. There'll be a poem in that.
Somewhere. Please share another piece of your work for us.
Okay. I thought I picked one that I thought might be fun because I do all this travel and try to bring the world or bring what I see and experience back to the world through my poems. So this one is from my book, Attaining Canopy, Poems of the Amazon. And it's called Defeat of the Amazon. I met the sauna primeval, 95 hot degrees of it, 95 degrees humidity, clothes sodden from step one, each footfall farther, a conscious caution against the poison promises of wasps, bees, those inch-long bullet ants. I tramped a mere 2 miles, but imagine mine more baton death march, Brazilian style, on a trail of sweat, near tears, worn down by a misery of fear amid the fecund trees of thorns. Excuse me.
I don't know what to say, Carla Lynn.
Excuse me.
Yes. What do you see, based on everything that we've shared so far, as being the role of a poet in modern-day society? And we probably talked about this a little bit, but
yeah.
What's our role? What's our role?
Oh, I think there's a couple things. I think part of our role is to bring beauty into a world that can be pretty ugly, whether it's poverty or battered women or violence in the cities or drug addiction. I think that's part of what we do. I mean, just even if the poem itself is a nasty poem or about nasty subject matter, it's still a work of beauty. And I think that's a part of it. And I think especially now we do need to witness. So if I'm writing a poem about the an endangered species, or someone is writing a poem about protesting a pipeline through their tribal territory. I think it's a combination of bringing beauty, more beauty into a world that crass materialism and the evils that are out there. Beauty and witness.
Beauty and witness.
Yeah.
I can relate to those. Mm. I can relate to those. Yeah. Please share another piece of your work. First, before we do that, let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Okay. All right. I'll have some more water.
Yes. One and only Michael Anthony Ingram.
Yes.
Carla Lynn Merrifield. The one and only Carla Lynn Merrifield. What advice would you give aspiring poets before we move into your piece?
Sure.
Based on everything you know.
You got to show up. It sounds kind of odd, but... there's always, you should read lots of poetry and listen to lots of poetry, but I think the bottom line is you just got to show up and put your pen on the page or your fingers on the keyboard. I guess I don't understand writer's block. I know a lot of people suffer that from time to time, mm-hmm. or are totally, incapacitated. By it. I just figure if I show up and I put my pen on my page, even if what I write doesn't, come to anything. I mean, there are hundreds of poems that just, never go anywhere. But boy, if you just show up and put your pen on the paper and you do it again and again and again and again, you're going to hit something. So I guess, show up. Show up.
Well, you certainly show up. Please share another piece of your work.
Okay. Here's one. This is from my newest book. Mouthful for a title. The book is called Athabascan Fractal, Poems of the Far North. So it's a collection of poems at the north of our continent. Alaska and high Canadian Arctic. And anyway, and this poem is set in Alaska. And this is why I think what I mean about witnessing in terms of our climate change and all that we stand to lose with what's happening to the planet. It's called Happenstance in Gustavus. On the night of mystic Alaskan rivers, straits, sounds, inlets, fjords, arms, bays, passes, narrows, coves, I tell you to come, curl into my body, that I may pearl our landscapes into this lesson of love. Because I was once depositional, I show you impatient puissance of glaciers. Because I was once erosional, I teach you voracious winds and waterways. I display the many pleasures of geomorphology among so many epiphanied seductions. I am mountain. I am boulder, I am cobble, I am pebble. I am grain of sand. I am your lover, your earth. I have time for your imagination.
Does knowing that your poems are published, and you've published extensively, and out there in the world, validate your being a poet, or are you content knowing that it's out of your system?
It's very validating.
Okay.
I mean, it's a rush. I mean, you labor in solitude. I mean, even if I'm sitting on an airplane going somewhere and I'm scratching lines towards a poem in my journal. That's the real rush, is the creation. And you keep doing it and doing it and doing it. But boy, you know, then there's that other rush that, oh, wow, you know, it's in print. And I think maybe just as much as being in print, to be able, like we're doing tonight, to be able to read them to an audience and have, and look, of course, I can't look at you right now, but, you know, to look at, I love doing readings because I love seeing how listeners hear them, and how they respond. And that's, you know, that is real validation. I mean, you know, poems go out there, but, you know, people buy the books or they don't, or they read your latest poem in a journal, and you never know. They're out there in the world somewhere. Hopefully, you know, they move somebody or change somebody or make them smile and feel a little better about their lives.
Right. What makes a poem good?
But it's the
good?
Genesis.
All right.
What
makes a poem good? I know that's subjective.
Yeah, of course it is. I think when you get that, first of all, it holds you.
Okay.
You make it to the end, okay?
Okay.
I mean,
right.
That helps. But when you do then get to the end and you have some kind of an emotional awareness of, a reaction, you know, a tear in your eye, or a chuckle, or there's truth. I mean, a realization that somebody spoke truth, or oh my God, that's so beautiful. So I think it's the it works if you are getting an emotional contact with your reader. I mean, I've read abstract poetry, and there's a lot of, I can see poetic in terms of the poetics that that's a pretty interesting poem, but it leaves me cold. So you know, I just put it aside. I think they're there for. Yeah. Or the light bulb going off, which is an emotional response.
Yes.
Wow, I learned something. Or like, who knew? You know, that discovery, the high of discovery. When you learn something.
How has your idea of what poetry is and what poetry can do changed since you began writing?
I've gotten better, obviously, at my craft, but I think it's richer in emotional. I mean, the maturity I bring to the poem, having lived through you know life experiences, I think they're deeper. I think they resonate better. Because I'm more practiced, and I bring you know the crone wisdom with me of having lived all these years and worked at it. So did that answer your question?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Please share another piece. I want to hear your work.
Okay.
No, I
want
to hear your work. Please share another piece of your work. And this time, share two.
Oh, all right. Share two. Okay. All right. I'm going to go out on a little bit of a limb here with this one. It's called How to Dress to Undress. Think silk, shimmery kimono to be unsashed. Artist-crafted caftan of open-sided access against your skin, against his. Think lace, trimmings of thigh-high stockings, frilly bra and flimsy panties, invitations to his fingertips. Think billowy, chiffon skirt for the easy slipping of his hand beneath, soft lengths of scarves to bind and blindfold your bold lover, shivery your promises to him. Think yourself nude. Be human landscape draped only in candlelight. Be womanly creature who welcomes him to paint your body with his imagination.
I don't know why I thought about the eroticism in a guitar. That just came to mind. All right. I went off on a tangent there for a minute.
No, I see the relationship. Oh, no. And the power of the imagination, which is what that
is
really all about. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Let me take you to Yellowstone.
You can take me anywhere that you like.
Okay.
Anywhere that you like.
Here we go. The title is Him, H-I-M, Him. We were up early and hiking alone. The trail through Yellowstone's volcano pots in heavy, cold mist, thick over the hillsides when he emerged and crossed our path, not 10 feet away. I held my breath, could hear his snorty breathing, steaming, then hooves sucking into mud, snowdrifts. He stopped close as fog rolled over massive shoulders, clung to the brown shag of mane and haunch. A single bead hung, dropped, and seemed to explode in a puddle, bursting the green-gray morning silences of bison passing us by.
Read one more.
Okay. All right. This one.
I feel like a kid in school. Please read one more.
Oh, all right. Okay. All right. This is a fun one. It's called When a 54 Fender Stratocaster Becomes a Fetish. Smitten thoughts. Girl, she's rapturing smitten thoughts about me. I got smiley halos above. I got me a smitten girl, smitten over me, whammy bar girl, string bending me with her pickup smitten. My smitten girl, sure to soon be amplified for me, a night plugged into her smitten hold on me, my grasp. She do electrify. When my zizzy smitten girl's up completely top volume, reverb within me upping my heart's pumping, newly smitten gal, I play you, play you, play you also jazzy melodies. Smitten girl mine, tune in.
Smitten girl.
Smitten girl.
Right. Well, we've come to the end of the program.
Oh, my goodness, so much fun.
Well, let me ask you this question.
I'm going to come to Washington
and
meet you.
That's true. One last thing. One question for the road. When people hear your work, they usually, I know they do, they want more. What's next for you? I know your book is being published in 2021.
Yep.
My Body, the Guitar. What else is on the horizon?
I've finished a collection of Haiga, which is an ekphrastic work. It's I'm working on the proposal to send it to a university press. It's honoring American artist John Sloan, who painted over the course of his lifetime hundreds of nudes, and I took 103 of them and superimposed my haiku on top of these drawings and paintings, and that's what makes them a haiga. Put a haiku on top of a piece of art, and you've got the old Japanese tradition haiga. So I'm hoping to get that out in the world. It's not a book that you, I mean, I'll do readings for it if I ever get it placed, but so I'm looking forward to that because it really, it's, I mean, I'm lost in this music thing right now, but I spent 18 months just living with John Sloan and his art and studying him and figuring out what he was up to. And this is, you know, my story of, in a way, it's a story through haiku of my relationship with this artist and what he taught me. So.
I don't know what to say other than thank you very, very much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
It's been an enlightening hour, and I wish you nothing but the best. Nothing but
too.
The best.
This
All
has
right.
been a delightful encounter. We'll stay friends, okay?
Yes, I'd like that. I'd like that very, very
okay.
much. Well, to the listening audience, I want to say thank you to you as well for tuning in. And we'll be back next week. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Good night.